Thanks for tuning in to the Direct Access to Oxford Physical Therapy podcast, where we talk about your body, how it moves, and empowering you with the knowledge to manage and treat your pain or discomfort. You will also get an exclusive behind-the-scenes look at a successful private practice. You have the questions, and we have the answers. Now let's get moving.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Direct Access to Oxford Physical Therapy podcast. This is Matt, your host.
And Allie, your co-host.
Thanks for joining us today. We have an exciting episode. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit of a nerd. I get excited about talking about different diagnoses.
Hey, if we didn't talk about things you liked, we wouldn't have a podcast.
That's right. But today we're talking about the dreaded plantar fasciitis. I'm sure everyone has heard that term.
Or has had it.
Yeah. And maybe wondered, what is that, you know, or talk to a friend, oh, they have the plantar fasciitis,
yeah.
You know.
What's it all mean? What's
exactly.
It feel like?
So this is basically inflammation and tendinitis, if you think of it that way, of where your arch attaches down in your heel.
In your foot.
Exactly. Yeah. In your foot. So right on the bottom where you walk. And most common symptom of this is pain in your heel when you first get up in the morning or when you've been maybe sitting for a while and take a first few steps, or if you walk for a long time and you start to hurt in your heel. So
really common with, like, I mean, really everybody in the day-to-day basis, but a lot with athletes too, right?
It can be. I think it can be common with athletes that have had a break and then get athletic again. So I think this time of year when the spring is hitting,
they've had their break, they're getting back to sport.
Yeah. Maybe you weren't walking, maybe you weren't out, you know, and the weather breaks, and you're like, hey, I'm going to go ahead and start walking again. Mm-hmm. You know, at the root of this problem a lot of times is flexibility. And so being real tight, particularly in your calf muscles, the muscles on the back of your leg, is really one of the biggest issues. So if you're listening and you've started to have this problem, or you've been a patient and you've been in our office, you probably learned this stretch. But quite simply, you can put a towel just beside your bed, and in the morning when you wake up, put the towel over your toes and just gently pull your toes back towards your knee to stretch your calf. A lot of people, if you look online, if you look at this problem, you'll see videos that talk about, like, standing on a stretch and and hanging your heel off. And that's not bad, but that's a, like, level 2, 3, 4, 5 stretch, and folks should start at a level 1 type stretch.
Okay, so when we were in sports, we were told to, like, go up to the wall and put your toe all the way up and then kind of stretch that.
Not a bad thing.
It sounds more vertical. That would be more
exactly.
Of the 5, 4, and 5 that you're talking about.
Yeah, so when you think about the one against the wall or the one on the step, mm-hmm. the commonality there is a lot of those are weight-bearing. So you're standing and putting weight on your foot. So initially, stretching with no weight on it is probably preferred, at least if this is a problem or a pain for you. If you're not having the problem and you're looking to prevent it, you probably can start with what Allie was talking about, where you're just putting your foot against the wall to get your calves good and flexible. You know, we've talked on other episodes about stretching and flexibility and pacing your activities so you're not overdoing it. And this is the same thing, you know. But if you do start to feel that pain in the heel, particularly trying to stretch it before you get up and walk is really, really key.
And it's not the total cure, right?
Nope, not the total cure. So remember, I mean, I would be remiss if didn't mention.
It's early on, guys.
You have direct access to physical therapy, so you can come straight in. And, you know, physical therapy is at the heart of treating this. And we're going to have the pleasure of interviewing an expert today, Dr. Michael Keel with Cincinnati Foot and Ankle Centers. And he's going to talk a lot about plantar fasciitis and different medical treatments that we can do. But one of the really cool things and one of the great things is if you are suffering from this, there's a 90% chance that this is going to get better with conservative treatment, meaning not need surgery. And at the heart of that conservative treatment, you'll hear Dr. Keel talk about this, is physical therapy. So remember, starting physical therapy, and remember, starting physical therapy early, as we've talked about on other episodes, and Dr. Keel will talk about today later, is going to keep you from developing compensations, which often can occur. If you think about your heel and your foot and how important that is to your walking and your movement, when it hurts, man, you'll do anything to avoid putting pressure on that. If you've ever had a rock in your shoe, think how funny you walk when a rock is in your shoe. If that's pain on the bottom of the heel, you're going to do a lot to keep from stepping on that rock. So
exactly.
Yeah.
A lot of the preventative stuff is key here. So exactly. Why don't we get Dr. Keel on the phone?
Awesome.
And we will talk later. Hold tight.
Well, like I said, thanks again for being on our podcast today, Dr. Keel. We really appreciate it.
No, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and your training and, you know, kind of some of the conditions that you treat?
Yeah. Originally, I came from Rockford, Illinois, and then went to University of Illinois in Champaign for my undergrad and got my degree there in a bachelor's in science. And then from there, went on to Des Moines University for podiatry school. And from there, on to Columbus, Ohio at Grant Medical Center, where I started my surgical training. I was there for 3 years, met my wife up there, and we moved down to the greater Cincinnati area in 2011, and I've been practicing here ever since then. We have two kids, and we reside in the greater area here in Mason. And
that's awesome. So I'm going to say, just for our listeners who may not be familiar with the term, what does a doctor of podiatry medicine specialize in or do?
So a doctor in podiatric medicine is someone who specializes in anything foot and ankle related, or in some states, including Ohio, any of the soft tissues and bone below the level of the knee. So we do anything from surgical ankle fractures to palliative, what we would call diabetic foot care in the office, including wound care, and also treating sports injuries, plantar fasciitis, and a lot of the common tendonitises, including Achilles and peroneal tendonitis.
Awesome, awesome.
That's super relevant now because we had just posted a podcast. One of our episodes recently was about running, and I think this goes along with a lot of those kinds of injuries that you guys see.
Yeah, especially this time of year, it's as people are getting out more and more in the spring, and when we start to get a break, we see a huge influx of the different tendonitis, including the Achilles and the plantar fasciitis especially. That's probably one of the most common ailments that we see on a day-to-day basis in the office.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you hear a lot about that, and that's kind of what we wanted to dig in and talk a little bit about today. So, you know, kind of explain to folks, what are the common symptoms you see of plantar fasciitis? How does someone know when this is starting? And, you know, what do they typically come in kind of complaining of?
Yeah, usually the most common complaint when someone comes in with plantar fasciitis is general heel pain. Usually complaining of heel pain more so on the bottom rather than the backside. And a lot of people, one of the main complaints is what we call post-static dyskinesia, but basically fancy term for first step pain. You get out of bed and you feel like you can barely walk, or you drive home from work and you get out of the car and you can barely take two steps. You kind of hobbled up. And that's probably the most common complaints with that.
And so is this typically something you see in patients that's kind of a rapid onset, or is this kind of usually build slowly over time, or a little bit of both?
It can be both, but a lot of people, yeah, it's more of a slow progression. Most people have that first step pain, and then they'll find when they start walking, it kind of eases, and then they don't think about it the rest of the day. And then over time, as it builds and builds and builds, then all of a sudden they start noticing that they've got pain longer term during the day, or they're noticing it more and more throughout the day where probably previously they hadn't noticed it. But also can be a sudden onset. I mean, it could be something, whether you took a trip to Disney World in the middle of winter and you walked 5 miles each day for 5 days in a row, and all of a sudden you're getting that heel pain from it, because it's more of an overuse syndrome, so then people start to notice that.
Usually, though,
like we said before, the main complaint is that heel pain on the bottom, and that's one of our diagnostic factors, is palpating the bottom of the heel and isolating where most of the pain is stemming from, because we also have to rule out things like a stress fracture in that area, or sometimes even some nerve damage or down in that area as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So the diagnostic process, obviously, you know, someone hurts on their heel, they start having difficulty with that first step, they might come in to visit you. And, you know, what's the process you're going to go through to determine and diagnose plantar fasciitis over, like you mentioned, a stress fracture or some other competing diagnosis?
Right. So the first thing is the physical exam, right? Palpating and finding out where their pain is. We do a test called a side-to-side heel squeeze, and that's usually more indicative of a stress fracture than just feeling the plantar fascia insertion on the bottom of the heel. But then also we do x-rays in the office to verify that there is no sign of a stress fracture or any other ailment in the bone, which could be anything from a stress fracture to even a bone tumor, and also have ultrasound in the office to actually measure the thickness and look for any pathology within the plantar fascia itself.
Okay, so you're getting an actual look at the tissue. So when we say, plantar fasciitis, and we kind of lump that into a category of tendonitis, is plantar fasciitis or a fasciitis the same in your mind as a tendonitis, or are there differentiators there?
I hope I'm answering this right, because you cut out on me for a minute.
But oh, okay, no problem.
You were asking if it was plantar fasciitis versus a tendonitis?
Yeah, up to a patient, they might wonder, hey, why is this called plantar fasciitis and something else is called Achilles tendonitis? Why wouldn't you call this arch tendonitis? You know, what's the fancy word and name about plantar fasciitis? Is there a difference?
Right, okay. Yeah, absolutely. So the plantar fascia is actually a ligament on the bottom of the foot. So usually when I'm talking to patients, I discuss with them that it's a ligament that covers the whole bottom of your foot, almost like my hand. And it attaches across the bottom of the heel. So it's a ligamentous structure that helps support the arch, called the plantar fascia. And where it attaches is usually where most of the people have the pain. So that's where it gets the term plantar fasciitis. And I talked before about that first step pain, and that's usually the most common indicator. And with that, usually when people notice that, or the reason they notice it, is after sitting or resting, because the foot falls to a more relaxed position. And as a person stands up or starts moving, the foot stretches out on the bottom and essentially creates a pull at the ligamentous insertion on the bottom. Now, some people can even get, a lot of people describe it as a heel spur syndrome is another term people use for it, or bone spur. But with the research and stuff that's out there, the bone spur is more a result of the chronic tension or pulling of that ligament. So it's not necessarily a cause of the pain. So a lot of times, even if we have to take people to surgery for this, or if we're doing different treatments, including cortisone shots, physical therapy, we don't get too concerned about the bone spur, as that's not the root cause of the pain. So that's a big thing to get across to a lot of the patients, because a lot of people do believe that the bone spur is the root cause of the pain.
Right. So the bone spur is more a result of the inflammatory process that's been going on, right?
Correct. And then the tension and the pull or chronic pulling of that ligament, and then the body in response to that says, hey, I don't like this. So it grows essentially a bone spur where the attachment of the plantar fascia is, which then makes the plantar fascia feel like a longer ligament.
Yeah. So that would be probably a point of encouragement to tell folks to kind of seek care for this on the earlier spectrum, and don't just assume, oh, mom had, plantar fasciitis or heel pain, I have to have heel pain too. There is treatment out there, and there could be advantages to getting treated early from what you're saying.
Absolutely. I would agree with that 100%. The longer we see this been going on in a patient, the harder or longer it takes for it to go away. From my experience, patients who've had it for a week going on, I feel like their symptoms cure or go away a lot faster with the different modalities that we use. Now, I would say by and far in my practice, I bet most people this is something that's been going on anywhere from 2 to 6 months, sometimes even longer, before they'll actually come into the office. Because usually in the beginning, it's just that little step. You get out of bed, you don't really think about it, and then you go on about your day, and it kind of goes away. But as it gets worse and worse, then you start walking different and putting pressures elsewhere on the feet, which then can cause problems in different parts of the feet, even different tendonitis. I mean, I have patients come in complaining of pain on the outside of their feet, and then you go and hit the bottom of their heel, and they about hit the ceiling, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, that's been hurting for like 6 months, but this is what's bothering me the most. And
yeah,
then you kind of come back, and if you go back and treat the root cause, then they tend to get better in the other spots.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up. We talk a lot about compensations and how, one small problem can lead to other problems. And, I think early intervention, early treatment's really at the heart of that. What might treatment look like for one of your patients in your practice with, traditional plantar fasciitis? What sort of regimen might you start them on?
So I go through kind of the same regimen, and I'm not going to say I use the same regimen on every patient, but I do give I call it pathways, Sure. And I say we can take pathway, you know, one, two, or three. And, you know, if we go down pathway one, it doesn't work, we can go two. And some people opt to start at two, and we can always go back to one, because most patients respond differently to different therapies. I mean, I could do one therapy on one patient, they're 100% better, and I could do it on the next patient, and they're no better. But the therapies that we most commonly do are the stretching exercises, physical therapy, anti-inflammatories, cortisone shots, sometimes arch supports, and I'm a big proponent of avoiding the barefoot in the home. I feel like that's, especially now with the pandemic and more people working from home and being more isolated to their home, the barefoot in the home on the tiles and the woods has really affected a lot of people, and I saw a big influx in the plantar fasciitis because of that.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I think that's a great you know, tip to dive into for just a minute there, because I really agree with you too. My kids are just a little bit older on the spectrum. My daughter's 15 and my son's 13, so they're growing like crazy. And my daughter's battling. She's a track athlete and cross-country runner, and she has a little bit of, you know, heel pain every once in a while. And then I catch her walking around the house on the tile barefoot.
Right.
So I'm glad you brought that up to folks out there. So rather than barefoot, do you have a special recommendation of something folks should wear at home? Are you a big fan of Crocs or Hokas or anything specific?
Definitely the fuzzy slippers, right?
Right. Yes. Those, I love those. No, my personal favorite, to be honest, is UFOs, O-O-F-O-S.
Yep,
they make sandals, clogs, slides.
Yep.
And I pretty much refer or tell a lot of people about them. They're recently now approved by the American Podiatric Medical Association, which was pretty cool. But I've been telling people about them probably, I'm going to guess, about 5 years now. I actually had a patient bring them to my attention, and I went and tried them, and they're great. But they make a whole variety, and the beauty of it is they're easily accessible. Stores, their website, or you can even get them off Amazon now.
Awesome. We love Amazon.
Yeah, well, that's a good tip. So one of the things that I have had patients ask a lot about in terms of treatment for this, and I was curious about your opinion, is what role do you think night splints might have in treating plantar fasciitis? If you could just give a little information about that.
Right. That's another, like I say, there's so many modalities of treatment and some respond different, but a night splint, as I talked before about how that foot falls to a relaxed position, the night splint helps hold your foot, not quite 90, but gets it up so it's not in that relaxed position, so you kind of alleviate some of that first step pain. So for some patients, they're great. I will tell you from my experience, I would guess more than 95% of people can't tolerate them for more than an hour or two in the nighttime. It's very rare I can find someone who can wear it all night. So I'm a huge proponent of those for people who have sit-down jobs or do a lot of sit-down work throughout the day, because it's something that they don't have to actively be stretching. They can simply put on the night splint under their desk and or at home or whatever, and it keeps that thing stretched out for them during the day.
Yeah, I think that's great. I agree, too. Just because it says night splint doesn't mean you have to just wear it at night or sleep in it, but I think that passive positioning is really key at times, for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, like I say, it's something that I use. It's probably not the first thing I jump to. I think the stretching, a lot of people don't do that on a regular basis. So getting them stretching once or twice a day, doing some anti-inflammatory if they can tolerate that, whether it's topical or oral. And then depending on the severity of the pain, you know, sometimes we jump to a cortisone shot, and that may be the first time I see them, but that may be three visits down the road. It all just varies on what the patient is experiencing with their symptoms. I mean, someone who's had it going for 6 months and their pain's a 9 out of 10, they're more eager to get some quick results than someone who's had it going a week and their pain is 3 out of 10. So
again,
as you said before, coming in earlier, I think makes a bigger difference.
Yeah, I appreciate the individualized approach. I know that has a huge impact for your patients, being able to tailor it to what they need. And, you know, I know you mentioned earlier it's not your first course of treatment, and I'm sure many, many visits and types of modalities down the road, but there could be a point where you do get to surgery for this kind of a problem. Can you just briefly describe a little bit of the type of surgery that might be involved and maybe kind of recovery process from your standpoint with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Surgery is usually you have to fail 6 to 9 months of conservative therapy, because usually more than 90% of people get better with the conservative therapy. So yeah. Like we talked before, the therapies, the stretching, sometimes walking boots, depending on it. And then if you do go to surgery, there's a couple different options you have. One, which I go to mainly, is what's called an endoscopic plantar fasciotomy. So it's a minimally invasive procedure where there's a small incision on both sides of the heel. I then place a camera or scope underneath the plantar fascial ligament, and you can visualize it. And then we release the ligament using a small, it's called a hook blade, through, or a triangle blade through the fascia. And we release the roughly medial or inside portion where that attachment is, and then essentially put someone in a walking boot roughly 2 to 6 weeks. And everyone's different. I've had patients back to work at 2 weeks, and sometimes people are in the boot upwards of six, but usually they get some good relief. Now, the other option is more of what's called an open fasciotomy, where we make a larger incision on the inside portion of the heel and go down and actually cut the ligament with either a blade or some type of strong scissor. And then at that time, if there is some bone spur, then shave down the bone spur as well. I usually do the endoscopic, and the one that I, the open IRE is used more in an instance if the endoscopic were to fail, which is not that often.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, I love what you said. You know, 90% of folks are going to get better with conservative treatment options, but it's good to know that there are still options out there for the 10% that, you know, may need that level of treatment and care. So that's great information. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners on this topic, or anything you feel like we didn't cover, a tip or a trick or anything out there that you might like to talk about?
Yeah, I think the main thing is, I mean, when you know you have an activity that's coming up, that you're ready for it. I mean, when the spring comes and you haven't run in probably 3 months, don't get out there and think you can run 4 or 5 miles. You have to build up. The stretching plays a major part.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, everyone gets that spring fever, and we see that huge rush of this at this time. And we also, like you said, talked about some of the other tendonitis, Achilles tendonitis, peroneal tendonitis, and it's all these are usually an overuse or some type of biomechanical walking different or something, or compensating for something else. So very important to keep up with kind of a routine stretching regimen, but also I think having the proper support. I think a huge thing that people don't realize is shoes aren't meant to last forever. I mean, the amount of people that, me, myself included, that try to wear shoes as long as we can.
They have a lifespan, right?
They have a shelf life on them, you know. So shoes are technically, I mean, for most shoes, they're good for roughly 300 or 400 miles. So depending on how avid of a walker, runner you are, shoes tend to break down a lot faster than we think. So that's where some of the orthotics and stuff like that come into play to help give you some added support and maybe increase the longevity of some of the shoes and things that you have.
Yeah, I think those are great points. I mean, like we talk all the time, you know, we would much rather put the effort in on the front side of things and, you know, get the right biomechanics, get the right flexibility, get the right footwear, because it's much, much easier to do the preventative stuff than it is to do the treatment stuff. And once things become a pain or a problem, then it's just much harder. So I agree with you.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, the modalities that are out there are usually, like you said, with a 90% basically cure rate, most people do really well. But then what we do see is that once someone does get treated, a lot of times we may see them back in the office, whether it's 6 months or a year later, because they, you know, once you're feeling good, you kind of fall off the bandwagon and stop doing the stretches or the things that we had discussed. But yeah, I think sticking to the support, trying to, you know, avoid the barefoot, especially in the home on the woods and tiles, and with kids too, even as you talked about your daughter. We see a lot of what's called sievers, which is actually not plantar fasciitis. It's we call it a disease, but it's not really a disease. But with kids, where the growth plate gets inflamed, and we need to use those supportive and soft sandals around the home. We need to stick to supportive shoes. But most importantly, doing the stretching. I mean, I had a little guy in the office just the other day, 9-year-old, sent in for physical therapy because he was so tight and he needs to be stretched out, and he'll probably do fine after that. But
Exactly. More or less.
So I think the therapy, the physical therapy, I should say, for plantar fasciitis in my practice has come in huge. I mean, the modalities. The hands-on is my favorite part of it. The deep tissue, the graspings, the dry needling and things like that, I found that it really helped people get over the hump, because a lot of times when that fasciitis has been going on for months, the body kind of sees it as a more dormant thing. It's nothing that's pressing, and it kind of goes on the back burner. But when we stimulate that, whether it's putting a needle in it or traumatizing it, the body now sees it as a new problem and then really tries to heal it.
Yeah, I agree. I think those techniques are home runs for this condition. And I'm glad that they're working for your patients as well. Well, I really, really appreciate your time today. That was a great interview. I mean, gosh, you have so much great knowledge to share, and you nailed it with the tips and the tricks. That's awesome. So thanks so much for being a part of it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. We'll probably be pestering you again because you were such a good guest that we'll be picking up another topic for foot and ankle and be bothering you down the road for. So,
All right, buddy.
Bye-bye. Bye now.
Thanks for listening. You can find us online at oxfordphysicaltherapy.com, and you can also find us on our social media pages like Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok. Remember, you do not need a doctor's referral to receive physical therapy in the state of Ohio and Kentucky, where we offer double the care for less than half the cost. You can schedule appointments online or stop into any center for a free screen, what we like to call a B-visit. Please write a review, send us a comment or message on our social media platforms, and until next time, keep it moving!